Today is Monday, February 1st, 2010. I'm Laurel Nimi, your host for The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. Today on The Wildlife, I'll talk with wildlife biologist and author Susan Jewell, who is an Indiana Jane of the wild world. We'll talk about her adventures studying wildlife throughout the East Coast, from owls and wood storks to alligators, rattlesnakes, coyotes, and bobcats. But first, let me repeat more of the creature calls from the Wildlife's first creature call contest. On January 18th, I played a series of 10 creature calls and gave listeners of both the radio show and podcast 4 weeks until February 15th to email me their guesses. The person who guesses the most creature calls correctly will win a copy of my book, Animal Investigators: How the World's First Wildlife Forensic Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. It's a wildlife CSI, and it was published by Scribner. If you're interested in entering, you can get detailed hints on these and the rest of the calls by listening to the January 18th podcast of the show. You can download this and other podcasts of The Wildlife at iTunes, my website, laurelnimi.com, or at laurelnimi.podbean.com. Let me now play creature call number 3 from the contest. This is the sound made by a marine mammal that grows to 50 feet long and is both an acrobat and singer of the sea. Now, let me turn to my conversation on the adventures of a wildlife biologist with Susan Jewell. You've all heard of Indiana Jones. Well, my guest today is an Indiana Jane of the wild world. Susan Jewell has studied wildlife from Maine to Florida by motorboat, airboat, canoe, airplane, helicopter, tree climbing, scuba diving, and muddy feet. She has worked for the National Audubon Society, the National Park Service, and others. Since 1992, she has been a biologist for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Her research has included such varied animals as bobcats, alligators, puffins, wood storks and other wading birds, marine fish, and gopher tortoises. In her spare time, she is a freelance writer on wildlife and environmental issues. Her books include Exploring Wild South Florida, A Guide to Finding the Natural Areas and Wildlife of the Southern Peninsula and Florida Keys, and Exploring Wild Central Florida, A Guide to Finding the Natural Areas and Wildlife of the Central Peninsula. Her most recent book is Gators, Gourdheads, and Pufflings, A Biologist Slogs, Climbs, and Wings Her Way to Save Wildlife. When we talked recently, I asked Ms. Jewell how she first got interested in the field of wildlife biology.
Well, that was a serendipitous combination of three things. First of all, my father is a physician, and therefore he has a background in biology and science, and he passed down his interest in science and nature to me. When I was a child, he would tell me about how things worked, like how rainbows formed. And second, my father spent his whole life saving people's lives and making the world a better place by taking care of people. He was a role model for finding something worthwhile to do with my life so that my life would be worthwhile. And third, I came of age in the late 1960s and early 1970s. And for those of you who remember what was going on then, it was the first major awakening of our country to the destruction we were causing to our natural resources. It was our first environmental revolution. And I was in high school during the first Earth Day in 1970, which, you know, in high school is an impressionable time for a young person. The media was full of stories and photos about air and water pollution. These were things I could see and smell. This was the time of the first Clean Water Act, the first Clean Air Act, and the first Endangered Species Act, too. So with my combination of my interest in nature, my realization that people were going to have to work very hard to reverse the damage to our natural resources that we humans had created, and my desire to make my life worth something, I had my path laid out for me in high school. I was going to save wildlife.
So you went to the University of Vermont and graduated in 1977, and then you started your career as an animal care supervisor at the Laughing Brook Wildlife Sanctuary, which was owned by Massachusetts Audubon. Can you tell me about the sanctuary and the kind of work that you did there?
Okay, well, Laughing Brook Sanctuary is about 350 acres in the Connecticut River Valley of western Massachusetts, and it's mostly wooded and has hiking trails, and it's in a town that's surprisingly rural. It was originally the home of a locally famous author named Thornton Burgess, who wrote children's nature stories until his death in 1965, and so the whole history of the area of Laughing Brook had to do with wildlife.
So that's the whole Mother West Wind story. It's quite famous, quite nice.
Yes, right, especially in that area. So at the time I started working at Laughing Brook, it was a bustling place of environmental education for the local communities, because that's what Thornton Burgess wanted. He left his land there to be an institution for teaching everybody, especially children, about wildlife. So we had indoor and outdoor live animal exhibits of native wildlife, and schools brought classes of children for tours on a regular basis. And the children would see local wildlife close up for the first time.
What kind of animals did you care for?
Well, we had quite the assortment of live animals. We had red foxes and white-tailed deer. We had porcupines, a skunk, woodchucks, raccoons, flying squirrels, great horned owls, screech owls, a red-tailed hawk. We even had two coyotes and two bobcats.
Really?
Yeah.
And how do you care for a coyote or a bobcat?
We had large outdoor enclosures, big chain link pens with pretty natural substrates, you know, the ground and rock dens, and tree stumps that they could climb up. The coyote pen had some dens that they could crawl into. They weren't really large, but they were pretty good for that type of a nature center.
How did these animals come to your sanctuary?
Well, most of them were in some way man-dependent. They had either been permanently injured by maybe getting hit by a car, or a lot of them really had been hand-raised, not by us, but by someone else, and because they were hand-raised, they couldn't be released into the wild. So we kept them really for educational purposes and used these animals that couldn't be released to teach children and adults as well.
Now, did people also bring you different wildlife to be rehabilitated?
Oh, for sure. We had a wildlife rehabilitation center there that I was in charge of, and people would bring injured animals of all types that they found, and I would either treat them if I could, or I had the wonderful services of a local veterinarian, and he treated the more seriously injured animals. We had a small area where we could keep them until they got well, and sometimes I had to bring them back to my house because I lived very near, about a mile away, in a really large old house that I rented with some friends, and there were many empty rooms, and there was a barn, and we had quite a menagerie there. We could keep some things in these empty rooms where we put whole branches that birds could perch on.
Really?
Yeah, cover the whole floor with leaves, yeah.
Did your roommates mind or your landlord mind?
Well, the landlord lived in the eastern part of the state, so he didn't know. And my roommates were bringing back things of their own all the time. They were just as willing as I was to take care of these things. In fact, one of my roommates was my predecessor, had the job before me at Laughing Brook.
So, oh, really?
Yeah, so it was great. They all helped me, and they helped me take care of these animals, and we all just had a great time.
So tell me about some of the animals that passed through your house.
Well,
I was interested.
One of them was a great horned owl that I had to raise, although I really didn't want to at first.
So how did you, what happened? This is in your book, Gators, Gourdheads, and Pufflings. You write about Sky King. How did you first meet him?
Some people had brought him in to our rehabilitation center. He was just a little ball of fluff when he was first brought in.
So how old do you think he was?
About 2 weeks.
Really? That young?
Yeah. He was very young. And the people who brought him in said that they found him on the ground and that the tree that his nest was in had been cut down. So I told them that the parent owls would still take care of it, even if the baby owl was in another tree. So I told them to put the baby owl up in a nearby tree as high as they could. Well, they insisted that there were cats all around and that it wouldn't be safe. So I told them to catch the cats. And they said, oh, that wasn't possible. So you see, I have a grievance about house cats running around outside. Because, yeah, they kill millions of birds every year without eating them. They just do it out of instinct, and it's really a waste. So the point is that I figured that the baby owl wouldn't survive with the cats, so I reluctantly took the owl. And the reason I was reluctant about it is because I knew that I would either have to do two things after I raised it. I would either have to find a home for it in another nature center, because we didn't need another great horned owl or have room for one, or I would have to raise it to be wild. And both of those were difficult because all the nature centers had great horned owls, and raising it to be wild is very tricky.
Why is it so tricky?
Because great horned owls are very large owls with very sharp claws, talons, and they can be very dangerous, and you don't want them getting used to people, and you don't want them being in an area where, like I said, it was pretty rural around there. People had chickens in their yards all over. There were, you know, house cats running around that were pets, and dogs, and great horned owls will take these as prey. Catching a dog would be not a problem for a great horned owl. So I had to be really careful about how I raised it.
And a great horned owl is, like, how big? A foot and a half tall, about?
That's about right. They're the largest owls that we have in the East and certainly around Massachusetts. Their talons are so sharp and their claws are so strong that they can penetrate through the skull of a small animal.
Really?
Maybe even a person. But certainly a small animal. That's how they kill. They'll kill skunks by swooping down and grabbing it by the head, and the talons can penetrate the skull.
Wow.
So it was tricky once this owl got to be a certain age for even me to handle it. I had to wear very heavy gloves, like welder's gloves, just to handle it, just to carry it from one place to another, which I did as little as possible because I didn't want him to get used to me.
So how did you raise it? And did you raise it to be wild, or did you find another home for it?
Yeah, I raised it to be wild. I did the best I could, and I'm pretty sure I succeeded, but what I had to do, basically, was to get, I never kept it caged. It was
Where did
always
you keep it? In your house?
At my house. Yeah. Yeah, this house was actually perfect for having an owl because it looked like a haunted house. It had no paint left on it. The hinges were falling off. I mean, the shutters were falling off the hinges. It was really huge and dilapidated because the owners really didn't have the money to keep it maintained. It had been in their family history for actually several centuries, and they wanted to keep it. They just didn't have a lot of money. So they were renting it to us very cheaply because nobody else but us poor starving naturalists would be able to afford it or want to live in it. There was a barn that I could keep it in. I kept it during the bird hunting season after it was old enough to be flying around. But mostly I just left this owl, which I named Sky King, by the way. I left him outside so that he would get used to being outside. And Sky King was a name that I picked because, well, for one thing, great horned owls, because they are so big and strong, have a nickname of Tiger of the Sky. And the other reason is because there was a TV show that I used to watch when I was a kid. Some of the listeners might remember a show called Sky King about a man who was a pilot and flew his little Cessna around the western skies of, I think it was California, and he would save wild Mustangs that were stuck in a hole or save lost children. Anyway, so that's how I came up with the name of Sky King.
Oh, that's
it seems fitting for him.
It does seem fitting.
Yeah. So I had to feed Sky King with live baby squirrels and rabbits when he got old enough to feed on his own, because that's what he was going to have to get used to eating. So I would release them out in the field, and he would go find them. And if he didn't, he wouldn't eat, because I stopped feeding him after a while. And he did learn. I did see him occasionally later over the years. He would come back to my house, and he would sit on the roof right next to my window at night, and he would do a little cooking sound with his bill, and that's a form of communication of owls. And I had no idea what he was saying, but I recognized that click.
So it wasn't pecking the window, but it was clicking.
Oh, no.
Right out.
So it's just clicking his bill together.
Huh.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about some of the other animals that you encountered there, like rattlesnakes.
Rattlesnakes and copperheads were native to that area, still are native to that area. The ones that we had in our nature center had been there for a while, and I don't even know the history of how they got there. I know the copperhead was, it was probably around 20 years old, which is very, very old for a copperhead. May have been a record for being in captivity. But the two that we had, and we kept them for educational reasons, but during the winter, we didn't give them the conditions so they could hibernate. So it was too cold in the nature center for them to eat properly, but too warm for them to hibernate. So they would stop feeding, though, all winter long. And I got worried about them, and I thought maybe I should get them to eat. And I tried everything. I tried making it warmer in there. I tried putting, you know, live mice and things like that, but nothing got them to eat. So finally I decided that I had to force feed this rattlesnake and this copperhead, or they might die. And nowadays I'm not sure I would have done that, but at the time that's what I decided to do. So I had to enlist the help of some of my volunteers, and I had some really good volunteers. They were high school students.
Did they still volunteer after that?
They loved it. Are you kidding me? This gave them great stories to tell. I did have to hand select them, though, the ones that I knew wouldn't flinch if the snake wiggled, and they had cool heads. And remarkably, some of these high school age students were just wonderful, completely composed when they were holding rattlesnake. So I would catch the snake first and get a good grip on its head, and they would hold the body. And then I would have to stuff a small baby rat or baby mouse down its throat, but I would have to hold the head tight enough so that the head couldn't get loose, but loose enough so that it could swallow whatever I fed it.
That's sort of like an art form.
Well, I had never done it before, and it was all new to me, but it worked fine, and the snakes lived. And when the spring came around again and there was more warmth and daylight, they got active again, and then they started eating on their own. Hmm. So, again, I still don't understand why I couldn't get them to eat in the winter, even if I provided them the light and the heat, but it was some natural cycle they had.
So they just wouldn't. They just...
Right. And the interesting thing is, even though they were awake, I could put a mouse or a rat right in the cage with them, a live one. And they were so the snakes were so sluggish, though, that the mice or the rats would bite the snakes. So,
no way, really?
Yeah. Well, they were pretty scared, and they reacted, and they were trying to defend themselves, and they knew the snake was bad, and somehow they sensed that they might actually be able to do some damage because the snakes were very sluggish. So it was odd to watch.
And what would the snake do when you'd have a mouse bite it?
Nothing. They were very sluggish.
Really?
Yeah, their body temperature was so low that they were just too cold to move. And like I said, even though I put a heat lamp there, nothing seemed to work. It's still a mystery to me.
Huh. That's really interesting. What other sort of mysteries did you encounter? What was some of your most strange experiences at that center?
Well,
and then we'll move on to other places.
Yeah. I had a really bad experience that I guess that was about my worst experience, and it was pretty strange. But like I said, we had two coyotes that we had in our pens. They were both hand raised before they got to us, so they had never been out in the wild, and they were not used to being out in the wild. But they weren't tame either. So this is a really embarrassing situation. One of the coyotes escaped, and it was my fault. It was because I had left its food dish just outside of its pen overnight, where the coyote, whose name was Shawnee, could see it and smell it, but just couldn't reach it. I had forgotten to put it inside her pen for various reasons. I was really busy at the time anyway. So she was so tantalized by it that she dug out of her pen, even though the chain link fence went down 2 feet, because we knew that coyotes could dig really deeply. Anyway, she got out. I got a call in the middle of the night at my house from the police, the local police, who said that they had seen a coyote and they thought it was one of ours. So in the middle of the night, I got down.
What made them think it was one of yours versus just a wild coyote?
Well, there were wild coyotes in western Massachusetts, but not very many, and we hadn't had any reports in that area of wild coyotes yet. And I guess it was not really acting like a wild animal. It was, you know, too calm, mm-hmm. And too used to people, and so it wasn't that afraid of the officer. So, and he knew that we had coyotes at Laughing Brook, which was right down the street. So I ran down to the nature center, and sure enough, you know, the outdoor pen, one of the coyotes was missing. So I got a tranquilizer gun ready and a dog catching pole, 6-foot-long pole. By that time, though, the coyote was gone. We couldn't find it. So we looked around all that next day, and the next night, I told the police, please call me, whatever you see, whenever. So they called me in the middle of the night again, and one of the officers, one of the officers had spotted it and actually was still watching it in the woods about a half a mile from the nature center. So I ran down there with a tranquilizer gun and a dog-catching pole and found the officer. He had his flashlight trained on her, and I recognized her. It was Shawnee.
And did she recognize you?
I really don't know. She was just kind of hunkered down, confused, didn't know what to do. And I didn't want to use the tranquilizer gun because it was dark, and I'd never used a tranquilizer gun before, so I wasn't too confident with myself on that. But if I did get her and she ran off and I couldn't find her, she could, you know, run into the road anyway. So... I decided to use the 6-foot-long pole with the loop on the end and try to get her around the neck.
That seems like a treacherous thing to do.
Yeah, and I didn't want to do that either, but I didn't have any other options. So I tried with the pole, and I just couldn't get her. I just couldn't reach her. So the officer said, here, let me try. So he tried, and after a while, he did get her around the neck. Well, she exploded in a frenzy, just, you know, whirling around and, like, all claws and teeth. And so then the officer looked at me like I was supposed to know what to do then. and like, I did this kind of stuff all the time. And, I, of course, I hadn't. Fortunately, I had never had a loose coyote before. So I'm
or a coyote at the end of a dog catching.
Yeah,
ball.
Right.
I mean, how did you hold on? I am surprised you could, you know, you guys could hold on to the pole with this animal.
Well, fortunately, the officer was really big and strong, and it took all his strength to keep holding on to her. So he's looking at me. Well, okay, ma'am. Now what do I do? We're looking back at his police cruiser, which is not too far away, thinking, like, could we get her back in there? But she would have just torn the car apart. So the only option was for him to drag her about a half mile down the street and, you know, like through the woods, down the street and back to her pen. And that's what he did.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm still eternally grateful to the Hamden Police Department for that. But he got her back there, and we had already fixed the pen by then, and we got her back safe and sound, and no reports of any chickens in the neighborhood that were attacked by a coyote, and no harm done.
Oh, but what a frightening experience.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And I never forgot to feed her after that.
Well, she taught you pretty well. She's a good trainer.
Yeah.
So tell me about your experience with bobcats. You were studying them for graduate school?
My project was about finding out how many bobcats were still left in the state of Connecticut and where they were, what kind of habitat they lived in.
Now, we have a lot of bobcats up here in Vermont. And what's interesting about bobcats?
Bobcats in general are neat because they are found all over the continental United States, down into Mexico, in every kind of habitat. They're one of the most widespread predators in North America. They will live in all kinds of habitats, from marshes, swamps, woods, mountains, deserts. They're so adaptable. That's what amazes me.
What makes them so adaptable?
Well, cats in general are pretty adaptable. Even their larger relative, the mountain lion, is found over most of North America in almost all types of habitats, too, although most of them have been wiped out.
What did you find in your study? How healthy was the population, and what challenges were they facing?
Well, there were pockets of bobcats in different parts of the state that were sort of still wild. Most of the state, they had been eradicated from long ago. But I estimated that altogether across the state, there were about 400 to 700 bobcats. They were mostly in the northwest part of the state and the northeast part of the state. The problem was that they couldn't get back and forth. There was a big corridor of an obstacle, a big barrier in the middle, which was the Connecticut River Valley, which was just full of urban areas, the Connecticut River, interstates, and just a huge barrier that they wouldn't be able to cross. So what the state agency wanted to know was if there were enough bobcats to allow for a hunting season of bobcats, because just recently at that time, the price of bobcat pelts had really skyrocketed. Just a few years earlier, a pelt would cost about, or would bring about $5 to $10 to the person who caught the animal. And at that time that I was doing the study, it was $300 or $400 a piece for one bobcat pelt. Well, that was a big incentive for hunters and trappers to go out and catch them.
Wait, so what year what year were you doing this? And the pelt went from $5 to $300 in that?
Well, it wasn't really that fast, but it was over a short amount of time, maybe 10 years. But this was around, I was doing the study in around 1981 and 82. And what happened was the federal government, there was a federal court that had banned the sale of spotted cat pelts until it could be proven that those populations of those animals could support a hunting season on them.
And people wanted to hunt bobcats for their fur, right? For fur coats.
People are so gullible that they would buy a fur coat made of bobcat, even though the pelts really aren't very good. They're not nearly as good quality as, let's say, mink or beaver muskrat or fox, something like that. Bobcat pelts have brittle hairs. They break easily. They're thin. They're not very good.
Oh, really?
But people wanted spotted cat coats. So they didn't know the difference. It looked nice.
Oh, that's interesting, but as far as keeping you warm and toasty,
not the best. Yeah.
And so did Connecticut start a hunting season on the bobcats?
No, actually they didn't. And I still consider that one of my great success stories, because to this day, as far as I know, that they have not ever had a bobcat hunting season since decades ago, before when people could catch anything, before there were laws protecting anything. So, yeah, since my study, they've never had a hunting season. So,
wow.
I'm happy about that. I'm not against hunting, but I don't believe that population could sustain a hunt there.
Tell me about your work with wood storks.
So I went down to Georgia and South Carolina pretty much both at the same time, because the project I was working on, which was on wood storks, was 6 months in Georgia, 6 months in South Carolina, based on when the nesting season was.
Who was the project with?
It was with the Savannah River Ecology Lab in South Carolina.
Okay.
And it was part of the Department of Energy's Savannah River plant, which was a big nuclear facility. It was not nuclear power, but they made nuclear-grade material for weapons there. I didn't actually have to work on the Savannah River plant. The wood storks were actually nesting over in Georgia, and that's where I would be out in the field. And for a wildlife biologist, to work on a species that big, and these birds stand about 3 feet high. They're one of the largest birds in the United States, but they had just been listed as an endangered species. To work on something like that was pretty exciting.
And what was the issue? Why were you brought in to study wood storks?
Well, that had to do with the fact that even though they didn't nest on the Savannah River plant, they would fly over there to feed in the ponds on the Savannah River plant. And the Department of Energy was planning to restart one of their nuclear reactors that had been dormant for a while. And to do this, they had to build a cooling pond. Anyway, this would affect the wood storks. And because the wood storks had been listed as endangered, the Department of Energy couldn't do anything that would harm the population of wood storks. So we were brought in to do a study to find out where the wood storks nested, where they fed, and what effect the Department of Energy would have if they did their plan. So it was basically a study to find out more about these storks, which no one really knew anything about. It was the northernmost nesting population of wood storks. And wood storks normally are found in Florida, Georgia, and they were just starting to spread into South Carolina only in the last couple decades, but at that time, this population in Georgia was the northernmost population.
Oh, really? And what's special? You said that, could you describe them? You said they were about 3 feet tall.
Yeah, they're about 3 feet tall and with a wingspan about 5 feet. They're mostly white with black wingtips and a black head, and their heads are featherless when they're adults. So they have these black shiny heads that kind of look like gourds. And that's where one of their local names comes from. Some people call them gourd heads. And yeah, some people don't know the name wood stork, so they call them gourd heads. And that's where part of the title of my book came from, which is Gators, Gourd Heads, and Pufflings. And pufflings, by the way, are baby puffins, which I worked on for a little while in Maine. So, but wood storks are really big, very striking, impressive birds.
Well, and why don't their heads have feathers? I know with like turkey vultures, they don't have feathers on their head because they're sort of always in the side, the carrion, eating.
Yeah, right. Same idea, except the wood storks aren't feeding on carrion, but they do have their heads underwater a lot. And they use their bills for finding fish and frogs, tadpoles, things that are underwater. And so the feathers would just get damaged. They would just be in the way. So they lose them after they're a couple years old when they
really
start.
So they're born with the feathers.
Yeah, then they're born with feathers on their heads. So while they're still in the nest before they go foraging on their own, they have feathers on their heads. They gradually lose them.
Huh. And so tell me about how you studied them and observed, you know, the nest. I know you did a lot of tree climbing.
Yeah,
and
well, these
wading
birds.
And
yeah, it was tough. This was my first real experience with field work, and it was pretty grueling circumstances, at least for a northerner. I grew up in the Northeast, and here I was in the swamps of Georgia where it was sweltering. It was like the heat index was 100 just about every day, it seemed like.
Wow.
But these wood storks would nest in cypress swamps in deep, dark places. And I worked with several other biotechnicians, and we each took our turns doing these things. We would have to wade into the swamps, sometimes alone. Sometimes it was, you know, your blind shift, and you had to wade through the cypress swamp.
And so,
alone.
how high up was it? Knee high, waist high?
The water would be about waist high, but it depended on what part of the season. You know, it could rain a lot, it could get deeper, it could be a dry spell and get more shallow, but it could be certainly waist high. There were alligators around.
Oh, really?
There were water moccasins, which is a type of venomous snake. So you had to walk very carefully through the swamp, and then you'd get to where the nesting colony was, and we had constructed, before the birds came in there and before we could disturb them, we had constructed a blind that was made of scaffolding like you use in construction. That was 70 feet high, just a tower of scaffolding, and we would have to climb hand over hand up to about 60 feet where a little canvas blind was, and sit there for 7 hours in the sweltering heat watching out of a little peephole and taking observations of the different nests. And then climb back down and, you know, wade through the swamp again. That was one of the things we did. We also flew.
And then were the birds disturbed as you came by, or was it far enough away that?
No, they weren't disturbed. We had it arranged so that they didn't see us.
Hmm. And then did you ever run into alligators or water moccasins?
They were around, and I did see them, but never had a close encounter. Well, not really while I was wading through the water. I did encounter an alligator that was on this little sandy road. I had to get to the blind by driving down this road that was just kind of like a dirt sand road. And this alligator was stretched across the road, and I couldn't get around, and I'm very conscientious. I had to get to my blind at a certain time, and like, you know, come on, alligator, but you don't just shoo it away.
So what did you do?
Well, I finally figured out that there was maybe just enough room for me to get the truck around beside, like on the very edge of the road. But I had to kind of inch it by, and I thought if I inched the truck by very slowly, it wouldn't move. The alligator wouldn't move. So I thought I would sort of be like an alligator myself, which alligators inch very slowly closer to its prey, and so the prey doesn't see it. So I sort of pretended I was driving a big alligator and inched it by, and I was just right next to the alligator, and its head was right next to my door, and it seemed like it was backing up, and I thought, oh, good, I can get by. But its backing up was just the first step before it lunged at my truck. You know, with a big hiss, it lunged and just rammed its snout right into my truck.
Really?
And I didn't want that because I didn't want the alligator to get hurt. But it pulled back, and then I got the truck past, and I stopped about 20 feet down the road and watched the alligator. And you can't tell by looking at an alligator if it's hurt unless it's bleeding, and it wasn't. But it just sat there, and kind of like it was doing before. So I don't know what happened to it, but I went to my blind shift, and I had to skedaddle down the road to the blind. When I came back, the alligator was gone, so guess it was okay.
Now, you kept in your career, you've kept running into alligators, and in fact that's included in the title of your book, Gators,
right?
Gourdheads, yeah. And Pufflings, so.
Yeah, Gators, Gourdheads, and Pufflings, right? And well, I did actually study alligators for a while when I worked at Everglades National Park. The research we were doing there was to determine the nesting success, because even though Everglades National Park is a huge area, 1.5 million acres, and it seems relatively undisturbed, it was really suffering bad problems as far as the environment. And the alligators there were very runty. They were not good, healthy alligators. If you wanted to find a good, big alligator, you could go up to Georgia or Louisiana where they were healthier, but the ones in the Everglades just seemed to be, on the average, several feet smaller.
Oh,
so
really?
we were trying to find out why.
And was this, who were you working for at this point?
Everglades National Park.
Okay.
I was working for the National Park Service. And so I would have to go out by helicopter and fly transects across the Everglades, looking for alligator nests at the beginning of the nesting season. So we'd be flying in a helicopter back and forth very low so I could find an alligator nest. And you can spot them because they look like little haystacks. Haystacks, yeah. Because the alligators, the mother alligator, will pile vegetation like cattails and other loose grass-like vegetation, and she'll just bite it off and pile it in a big pile about 3 feet high, and it looks like a little haystack.
Really?
So you can spot these from the air. So when I would see one, I would, you know, point it to the pilot, and he would land pretty close but not too close, because we didn't want the disturbance from the propeller, from the rotor, to blow the nest apart, but not too far, because I would have to wade through the water to get to the nest.
And is the helicopter on floats or something to land in the Everglades?
Yes, it's on pontoons, so it could land in the water. Mm-hmm.
Oh,
so
wow.
This was a marshy area with sawgrass, and the water would be maybe 2 feet deep or so. 2-3 feet deep. And so I would wade over there, and I always had a buddy with me. I had a partner, and the partner would have a long pole with him or her, and he or she would hold this long pole in front and look for the female alligator, because the females guard their nests. After they lay their eggs, they hang around the nest, which is not typical of reptiles. Most reptiles lay the eggs, and then they're gone, and they never see the young. and they never know what happens to their young, but the alligators will stay, guard the nest, and maybe even occasionally put some water on it if it hasn't rained for a while.
Really?
Yeah, because the way that the eggs get enough heat to incubate is by the vegetation rotting. And this rotting, it creates its own heat source, just the rotting material, and plus the sun.
Sort of like a compost bin.
Exactly, exactly, yeah. So if it hasn't rained for a while, the rotting may kind of slow down. So the alligator may splash some water on it, may even urinate on it to get some moisture in there. Anyway, the mother alligator will hang around, and she's guarding her young, so she's pretty protective, and you don't want to mess with a mother alligator and get between her and her nest. So I would have to have somebody that would stand guard. And it wasn't that big of a deal because the alligators out in the middle of the Everglades were not used to seeing humans. And even though I don't consider myself tall, in fact, I'm only about 5 feet tall, I would look like a giant next to an alligator that was, you know, down in the water below me because they're looking up. And so they're still kind of timid of anything that looks bigger than they are. So they would try to stay back. And generally it wasn't a problem to go to the nest, and we had to even open up the nest and take out the eggs.
Why would you do that? What would you do with the eggs, or what would you?
Because we were looking at each individual egg, and we could tell by just looking at it from the shell pattern on the outside whether that embryo inside, whether that egg was fertile, whether there was an embryo. Because it was part of the shell would be a little bit thicker and more opaque. So we would have to also count the number of eggs and very carefully mark where each egg came from and put it back in the same place and do this very quickly because the eggs would need that temperature to develop properly. And in fact, something very interesting is that the temperature of the egg as it's incubating determines whether the alligator turns out to be a male or a female. So if the temperature is above a certain temperature, I think it's above 90 degrees, it will become a male. The embryo will become a male. And if it's below, I think it's 86 degrees Fahrenheit, the embryo will develop into a female. And in between those temperatures, it could become either male or female. So we had to make sure we got it in the right place in the nest because the temperature varied within the nest depending upon whether it was high or low or in the middle or the, you know, whatever. So, but the interesting thing about this temperature, which is called environmental sex determination or ESD, is that if the temperature outside the nest changes, that could affect the temperature inside the nest. So some scientists think that the dinosaurs, which were reptiles, had a similar type of embryo development that was dependent on temperature, and that if something caused the temperature of the atmosphere to change, like a huge volcanic eruption or something like that, that made it cloudy all the time, that you could end up with all males or all females, and boom, you've got the extinction of the dinosaurs.
And could that same thing happen with global climate change now? Is that a concern?
That's a good point. I believe it can, and I think other scientists believe that it can too. Just a change of a few degrees of air temperature around the nest might very well mean that we could end up with all males or all females, and then that could cause the extinction of alligators.
Wow. Because it's not a big temperature difference, really, that determines
not,
one or the other.
Not really, no.
So what happened with the eggs?
Did you go back to see if the eggs hatched later, or you were just counting eggs and seeing if they
and leaving them? Right. No, I would go back. I actually would take several of the eggs with me to figure out what the best time was to go back. So I would have to age the embryos, and that would kill them, but we only took maybe 3 eggs from each nest, and there would be quite a few eggs left. So it wouldn't affect
the population. In each nest normally, 20 or something? Or?
Yeah, 20, maybe 30. Yeah. Yeah, more like 30, I think. And so I would be able to tell from the age of those embryos how long until they were old enough to hatch. And we knew that was about 56 days. So I would count out 56 days and you know, from when I thought those eggs were laid, and then go back there. We would wait till the nests had hatched. And so I would fly over and look for the nests where the eggs had hatched. And you can see that from the air, too, because that little nice, neat haystack was kind of apart. And it would look like a big chunk had been taken out of the side where the mother alligator would help the young out, because when the young, the little embryos or the young ones inside the eggs are ready to hatch, they start calling to the mother.
While they're still
in the eggs. Yeah, well, they're just hatching out, and yeah, so still in the eggs and just starting to hatch out, and it's a little, And so she calls to them, or they call to her, and she starts opening up the nest because the babies aren't really strong enough to move all that vegetation out of the way. And but they can get out of the eggs themselves, but once they get out of the eggs, the mother has to help them out of the nest and away from all that vegetation.
If the mothers weren't around, the babies would just die in the nest without food.
That's right.
And then what does the mother do after she helps them out of the nest? I mean, does she abandon them like most?
No. That's, again, very unusual for reptiles. She stays with them for about a year. She protects them and watches over them while they grow. Sometimes she even moves them. And she might even move them right after the eggs hatch, because it could be that the place where the nest was isn't exactly the best place for the young to stay after they're hatched. So she might carry them, and this is really interesting too. She will take the little babies, they're only about 8 inches long, in her mouth and carry them gently as she's swimming to another area, and then drop them down and then go back for more.
Really?
Without injuring them, that huge mouth that can crush a turtle shell, she'll carry her little babies in her mouth.
And then did you figure out why the alligators in the Everglades were generally not as healthy as other alligators? What was your conclusion?
Yeah, we kind of already knew that before, but we had to do some documentation to prove some things and to support what we thought. But the Everglades has been suffering for decades from man's intervention. We've dug canals, we've built levees, we've got roads crossing, we've diverted water for agriculture and for municipal use to supply drinking water to all the homes around Miami, Fort Lauderdale, West Palm Beach. So the Everglades is kind of a shell of what it used to be when it was healthy. And we've really interfered with the plumbing system, so to speak, of the Everglades. The water doesn't flow in the same pattern that it used to flow. And this affects the fish, the frogs, and all the turtles and all the things that alligators feed on. And so they really don't have a good enough food supply. And that's one thing that we think, probably the major thing. Also, the Everglades has a surprisingly large amount of mercury, and that could play a role, as well as some other pollutants. But mostly it's the fact that the prey base is not what it should be.
And has that changed over time as a result of your study?
Well, even at the time that I was working on alligators, there were plans to restore the Everglades as well as possible, which is not possible to completely restore them. But the Everglades is in the center of a huge restoration project with federal agencies, the state of Florida, even local municipalities and stakeholders, almost $8 billion restoration project, the $8 billion with a B. And it's going to help, but it's going to take many decades. So the work that I did directly really didn't have any effect directly, but it's part of the whole big plan.
If someone wanted to get into wildlife biology, what would you recommend?
I'd suggest at a minimum that someone get a four-year college degree in the field, but I'd also suggest a master's degree in the field, partly because the competition for jobs is pretty stiff, but mostly because a master's program would provide a good way to learn field techniques and to prove to potential employers how well you can run a research project. A master's program will separate some of the more serious students and give employers a good idea of what you can do on your own. You can also get a PhD, which may give you greater standing for higher-level jobs. And I should say that all this fun and interesting field work is not what the higher-level biologists get to do anymore. It's usually you do that when you're early in your career, and then you move up to a desk job, and which is where I am now. I have a master's degree, and I'm very glad that I got it. I don't have a PhD, though, and I often regret that.
Oh, really? Why?
I think it would have been interesting. Even some of my colleagues right now who are mid or even later level in their careers are going back for their PhDs. A lot of it is just because it's really neat to get that deep in research and kind of be in charge of your own research.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate your taking the time to talk with me.
Well, I'm very happy to do it, and I hope people got a good idea of why it's so interesting and so necessary that we do this work to help wild animals.
I hope you enjoyed those insights into wildlife biology with Susan Jewell, the Indiana Jane of the wild world. Now, let me replay you creature call number 4 from the creature call contest. This sound comes from a reptile that lives in freshwater rivers, swamps, and lakes in the southeast United States. It nearly went extinct from hunting, but is now abundant. Here's creature call number 4. To enter the Creature Call Contest, you can email me your guesses of the 10 sounds anytime before 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Monday, February 15, 2010. You can send your email to me at laurel@laurelnemi.com. That's L-A-U-R-E-L at Laurel Nemi. That's L-A-U-R-E-L, N as in Nancy, E, M as in Mary, E.com. For detailed hints on all 10 animal sounds in the Creature Call Contest, you can listen to the January 18th episode of The Wildlife via podcast. You can find this and other archived episodes of The Wildlife on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can also stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com. You can join me next week when I talk about the amphibian trade with Alejandra Goyenechea, International Counsel at the International Conservation Program of Defenders of Wildlife, and also Chair of the Species Survival Network's Amphibian Working Group. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.